everyone. Thank you so much. My name is Miranda Wagner. I am the agricultural conservationist with the Sherburne Soil and Water Conservation District. And today we are going to be talking about irrigation. In the first episode, we talked about best management practices for turf. And now we're going to shift gears into more of everything else that we see in Sherburne County, which is a lot of pivot irrigation. So today we have Jake Wildman, Ryan Peterson, and Keith Olander, and I'm going to let them do their own introductions.
Thank you, Miranda. My name is Jake Wildman. I'm from Glenwood, Minnesota. Farm about two-thirds irrigation, one-third dry land. Up in this area, I'm in the Bonanza Valley groundwater area. We farm to try to keep it somewhat diverse with the different soil types we have, but it's corn, soybeans, wheat, canola, and peas and sweet corn for a vegetable company. And I'm farming with my dad for about 10 years now. And I'm also the president of the Irrigator Association of Minnesota.
All right, Ryan Peterson. I live in Clear Lake, Minnesota. I farm with my brother. We do corn, seed corn, soybeans, kidney beans, black beans, and hybrid rye. All 90% of it's under irrigation. Little bit of dry land in there, and I'm president of East Central Irrigators and on the board for Ben Sherburne County Corn Growers.
Good afternoon, everyone. Keith Olander. I lead a center of excellence for Minnesota State Colleges and Universities called AgCentric. We're fiscally housed at Central Lakes College. My background in agriculture, I've been an ag educator for about 30 years, both high school and post-secondary. I farm personally dry land, corn and soybeans. And then at the college, we run a couple thousand acres of research and demonstration that is all irrigated. And so I've been involved in a number of presentations and policy background, I guess, just providing education information about irrigation. And then very specifically, what I'll share later today is this idea of farm business management. So we look at the economics around precision irrigation as well as general irrigation, and how do we help support farmers going forward and making decisions about that.
Thanks, Keith. So what is the Irrigators Association of Minnesota?
So I'll probably take that one. I am Irrigators Association of Minnesota. I'll refer to IAM just for short. We are basically, we were established in 1975. A group of farmers in actually the Bonanza Valley, Brewton, Belgrade area got together and said we need to start an association that represents irrigators throughout the state. And from there, in 2022, we were able to reach 500 members. So we've seen membership grow over the last, probably half a dozen years, which has been great. It's always tough to get members in some of these organizations, but we've been fortunate to see the members grow. And we're basically, I think it was first started out when they first created the organization, they were looking at the research and advising farmers on using best management practices, and we still do that today, no doubt about it. We work very closely with Vashu Sharma. We support her research at the University of Minnesota, but we've also transitioned and really have put a focus, a priority into legislative issues that have been taking place down at St. Paul at the Capitol. So we spend a lot of time in the winter having meetings with DNR, different legislators. Each year brings a new challenge. But we have really good representation down there in St. Paul. So we don't have to be down there every day, but we try to get down there at least once a year at our day on the Hill. We're just a group that advocates for irrigators across the state. Doesn't matter if you're irrigating crops, or we have some horticulture members, just a wide variety of people, that anybody that uses water, we invite to our organization and support them and advocate for them. So
thanks, Jake. Do you have anything to add, Ryan? You guys have been part of the irrigators for a long time.
Yeah, irrigation means kind of the world to us down here in sands of Sherburne County. We've been irrigating since the late 70s, and if it wasn't for water here, we'd pretty much be desert, I guess I could call it that way. So my dad was big in IEM for many years. So it's kind of a passion on our hearts on how to properly manage and grow crops here. So
yeah, for if you think about Sherburne County, it's primarily sands, except for some pockets of some wet areas. And so for as many issues as, you know, people have with just getting turf established, think about trying to grow crops in that same sand on a large scale and making a profit on it. So sometimes we forget how incredibly sandy Sherburne County is. We don't take our trucks out when it's wet or when it's really dry because we're going to get stuck in the sand.
Yeah, our like the right where we farm there, we have figure we got about 10, 12 inches of topsoil and about 80 feet of gravel. There's yep. No holding capacity at all, which can be good and bad.
So, or does IAM do a lot with education? I'm passionate about education and teaching people about, you know, how farming kind of works in with society. Does IAM work with that?
We have. We're constantly exploring different ideas on because it's such a big part about educating everybody about irrigation. I feel it's a very complex, unique practice that not a lot of people are familiar with. So we've actually partnered with AgCentric and Central Lakes College on a few things on working with them on trying to do an outreach, becoming better at outreach to people and to exploring different ideas to just educate the people. I mean, we really put a focus on educating legislators, but just having that education for the general public is ways that we struggle with, because we, you know, there's just so many different avenues you could go down and what's going to be the best efficient use of our time and resources. And so we're always exploring that opportunity and would love to provide education because I think that's, if we can tell people why we do it and what we do, we can have nice conversations about it, but it's just getting that initial conversation started and, you know, finding the right strategy to move those ideas forward is a challenge. So.
Well, Keith, you guys have a pretty cool tool now with your little mini pivot irrigator. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's been one of the projects that came out of our project, this RCPP, this NRCS funded grant, where we're helping producers, you know, try to invest a little bit more in precision irrigation. And one of the tools in under education is to have a model irrigator we can carry around. And then, of course, it is actually built by our robotics program and moves across the plane, so to speak. It's a field that we've got. And as it moves across, then it demonstrates how the nozzles would turn on and off, try to simulate what we think of in precision irrigation, where we drop the right amount of water, right place, right time.
And if you don't grow up around irrigation, I definitely didn't grow up around irrigation, you really don't know how it's working in the field. So who wants to give this 30,000 foot view of how an irrigator moves around the field?
Well, I guess I could try and take a stab at it here. So as far as 90% of irrigators, I guess, is work in a radial in a circle fashion. There's a couple other outliers out there, but so you have your basic pivot point. That's where the pivoting happens, the center of it. And that kind of goes out in different lengths depending on what your field is. And then just kind of goes around in a complete circle if you get the right perfect square fields or else it kind of half swings and then up as a pivot goes along with just all the different nozzles we'll set on it to put out the right amount of water from the pivot point all the way to the end.
And I'll just add quick on the nozzle. I'll just add quick on the nozzles. As you move from the closest to the center out, those nozzles get bigger. So because it's all converting back to amount that individual tower. So there's normally on a quarter section, there's eight towers. And you'll, so each one covers Obviously, the further out you get, we'll cover more acres. So to get that consistent half inch, three quarter inch, whatever you're putting down, you will nozzle it different. The size of the nozzles will increase in size as you move down further away from the center. So with the goal of trying to have that consistent application amount throughout the entire 1,300 feet or 1,200 feet or however long your system is. So.
And it's important to remember, it's not just about, you know, getting water. We also, you know, the plants are transpiring as well, right? So when you're deciding when to turn on the pivot, you're thinking about soil moisture. You're thinking about the temperature, the wind speed, all of these things go into turning on that pivot.
Yeah, a lot of that evapotranspiration be the word of the day there, I guess, for that. And we're all monitoring through a lot of scientific data on what's happening as a plant's growing from little to big. It's going to be using more water. Depends on temperature outside. You know, as you say, an easy one is crops are, you know, tall corn and stuff. You're up 2/10 a day, you know, pretty easily. When it's really hot outside, it's using. So you're kind of trying to keep up to keep that plant healthy, watering accordingly.
And you kind of touched on this, but there are critical periods throughout, you know, an individual plant's growth stages where it's imperative that they're getting enough water, and it's going to be different for all of your crops. So soybeans, you might need more water at a different time than corn. So when you're driving around Sherburne County and you see some pivots going around, it seems like 24/7. Well, how long does it take a pivot to get around a full circle?
Anywhere from 2 to 4 days, depending on the pivot or the well capacity. We have one that takes almost 4 days to put an inch on a 55-acre field, and then we have a couple that might take a day or 2 days to do it. So it kind of varies depending on your water capabilities.
Yeah, it can be tricky on those really hot days where you're at a critical period for that plant where you might just have to keep putting water on, trying to keep up. So what are some of the technologies that you can use to, you know, do the best job that you can do for putting water on?
Well, you start with like soil moisture, you know, you start with some simplistic soil moisture probe tests or a shovel, just in the simple sense of checking the soil. And but then you kind of move up from there, being the remote control technology and the different panels you can put on to properly measure and that direction, I guess.
The simplest thing is a shovel and a rain gauge, right?
Yeah.
Those are the simple tools. And then you can go all the way up to some pretty phenomenal technology where you have sensors in the field giving you real-time data about how much water you have available for plants. And you have rain buckets that tell you, you know, how much rain you got, how much irrigation you got, you know, and you can do that from the comfort of your home office, right?
That's correct.
If it works.
In the last 10 years, wouldn't you say that technology has changed and improved a lot in what you can do?
Yeah, I what got me interested in irrigation, I grew up around, it's been on the farm all the time, but a big thing that got me interested is I worked for a crop consultant during college during the summer, and we did some irrigation scheduling for some individuals, and that was only 10 years ago, 9 or 12 years ago, we were using tensiometers. Well, tensiometers at that time were they still are an awesome tool. Don't get me wrong. They're a simple, awesome tool, but they take a lot of maintenance to make sure that they're working correctly. And where I've seen that to where we're at today, it's it's amazing how far the technology has come. And not just in the sensors, but in, you know, the VRI technology, the variable rate application technology, and the pivots themselves and the panels. I mean, a lot of these newer panels, the top of the line ones there, and on some of these that come standard on the new irrigators, I mean, they're computers. They are computers within that panel. It's based off a Windows operating system. So, I mean, it's just amazing how far, like I said, just, you know, just having a little bit of experience in the management portion of it growing up and where we're at today. And like Ryan said, a shovel, you can have a shovel, a rain gauge, and some weather data at a local weather station. I still think you can do a pretty dang good job managing pivots. It's just this other stuff is available to people who are more willing to jump in and explore that new technology, which is, and I think it's just going to continue to improve, and it's just, it's going to be pretty exciting. Even where we'd be at 10 years, if we came back and talked 10 years from today, where we're at, you know?
So all of this technology, I've seen some recent price tags. How attainable is that for most farms, do you think, to get that Cadillac VRI VFD system? So when I say VRI, variable rate irrigation, and VFD, variable frequency drive on your pump, can most farms actually afford to do that on all their pivots?
The VFD side, I would say that's not cheap, but it's more attainable, and some guys do benefit from that, just that alone, the variable frequency drive. The VRI on itself, though, that is very expensive, and the hardest part to say there is you might not, and you're not going after it to boost your yield a lot. You're there to be more efficient and more level. You're going to hopefully level out your yield over the whole field in certain spots. So it's very hard to say I'm going to spend this without me making 50 more bushels the acre. So
yeah, it's less about a yield change, but more of a efficiency, using water wisely, using your resources wisely, which in the end can hopefully improve the bottom line, not necessarily your yield data. But I'm going to throw a curveball at Keith. And do you want to talk about the RCPP?
Sure, I can do that, Miranda. The RCPP is a federal program that we applied for with Department of Agriculture and the Soil and Water Conservation Districts. And within that, we've been able to deploy $2.2 million to about 38 producers to help them in various ways do their upgrades. So for some producers, they can outfit old systems. Sometimes it's just a panel move. Sometimes it's, you know, some of the producers are just moving to the soil moisture sensors. So there's a range of steps at which they're engaging in technology and what fits for their farm. Because it is through NRCS, then there's a series of enhancements, what they call enhancements, where you have to meet the criteria. So you have to be in certain watersheds, for example, and I'll show you in a little while the counties that we're targeting, where that's, you know, most predominant in terms of the intense irrigation under that. But this program is meant to support producers to migrate to new technologies. And then the other side of that, how does we help educate for adoption? I think widely, and I think Jake and Ryan certainly, you know, would back this up as far as this idea, they want to do what's best for the land today as well as for the next generation. So technology is certainly coming and we want to adopt and move that forward, but we've got to do that in a way that's practical financially, you know, and make that fit. So, yeah, I guess you look about a 20 county area is where we did that and those producers. And we're just, when I say those producers have been chosen, there's actually 2023 is when that actually will be deployed as far as getting the technology up and running. So by the 2024 season, it would actually be enacted. And then we'll start looking at the data on the backside as we go forward, hoping to compare the new systems to what we would consider conventional systems and see what the differences are in water conservation and perhaps even energy conservation.
And there should be some of these systems were funded in 2022, So hopefully early 2023, we'll start seeing some of these systems up and running and starting to collect some of that data to see how they're benefiting not only the operators, but also the natural resources that we're utilizing. And IAM has been a supporter of a lot of this as well as the Minnesota Irrigators Program.
Yeah, we were asked to be a partner with that RCCP program. I've sat in a few meetings in the planning process. And we had an update at our IAM annual convention in February. And when it was told that basically, and Keith, correct me if I'm wrong, but basically the funding in about a year and a half, two application process was used up, that $3.5 million. And that was just, it blew me away. I mean, not that I didn't think the program was going to be successful and it was a great program, but just how quick. And I think I'm very excited that, you know, us farmers were willing to adapt the technology and to have that program be so successful right off the bat was exciting to hear. And I'm very excited to see, you know, where it all ends up and get to see the data with it. And when Keith and his group take the data in and look at that and analyze that, it's I think it's such a wonderful program that I'm glad that we were able to utilize it as irrigators throughout the state, and it gives guys the opportunity to dive into some of this technology and have some cost share opportunity if they were a little nervous to do it on their own. And so I think it's a win-win for everybody involved. So.
Well, and speaking of data, Keith, I think you like data. Do you want to talk a little bit about some of the economic side of irrigation in Minnesota? What does it bring to the state?
Sure. Thanks, Miranda. Yeah, I get pretty excited about data, which is probably not normal of all people. I do think that however we can support farmers in going forward in data-driven decisions, you know, the dollars that go through a farm nowadays is considerably more than ever. And just that management of money alone is pretty critical. So that's a lot of our role within farm business management. And I'm going to talk very specifically then about this, you know, irrigation. So the map on the left there, you see the blue, that's the counties that I'm going to talk about here, but it also represents a lot of the RCPP counties as well. And I think we need to talk about marginal land here, because some people would say, well, why is it that, you know, we have this sandy soil and we irrigate it for crop? Why don't we just leave it to those that have clay soils, right? But the other side of this is from a consumer perspective, we got to understand that crops like edible beans, for example, where I sit here in Todd County, the 5-county area, produce 50% of the edible beans. So specific of those in chili or related types of foods like that, we also are a large exporter in Minnesota of these beans across the world. And that's something that they like dry feet, which is interesting. They need their water at the right time, but they do not. So what I'm getting at is clay soils don't fit them. The other side of this is potatoes. I think everybody indulges in that certainly every week, if not every day, in some form of a potato. And they love our soils in terms of how we can operate within a coarse sandy soil. So I think that's relative to what we're talking about here. So the annual impact of irrigated acres or agriculture in Minnesota. On the right there, I talk about farm business management. If you're not familiar with the program, look at these colleges represented there. It's across the state. We've got over 2,000 producers that are regularly in this program. It is an education program. However, it all takes place on the farm. Nobody ever attends a college building or a physical college setting unless they choose to from that standpoint. So just some background on that, and you can check that out further at our websites going forward. So then if we go from there and we look at actually what the data is, and this is interesting, you know, when I say these statistics, particularly to farmers, they're like, well, duh, this just makes sense, right? But this irrigated land, you know, 115% more profitable, and we're looking at 2021 here, or 113% more profitable over a 10-year average. But I really think from a consumer perspective, we've got to tell that story. You know, we do this with very much intention about what it does for our soils, for our land, and for our farms and for the next generations. You know, if we're going to have a dry land acre versus an irrigated acre, and I look at inputs, be it fertilizer, chemicals, seed, whatever, largely they're going to be roughly the same. But what I can be more assured of when I irrigate is that I'm going to utilize those nutrients and bring a crop back out of it. So really, when it comes to wise use of resources in our environment, irrigation makes a lot of sense when it comes to our coarse sandy soils. And without getting a lot of depth here, I think you can look at, you know, in 2021, there was 51 particular farms here. We look to this crop here, and just looking at that overall piece of what the return was, you see the yields there, both in a 2021, a 4-year, and then a 10-year average. And then what we consider normal on our, we have irrigated in the green, and then normal is dry land. And so what we did is we took these 9 counties and we put cornfields side by side. And so you see that, you know, just represented, for example, 213 bushels on irrigated versus 137 on dry land. And that's real. So just when you look at an overall return, it makes sense. Now, keeping in mind that both are all farmers, these pivots are very expensive. We've talked about that, you know, from an investment standpoint. So it's not like it's just automatic. We do this and flip a finger. It takes time to bring a farm into this particular production setting. Soybeans, no different. You'll see that there between the differences on 2021, 56 bushel per acre versus 39. And when you multiply that over the course of an irrigated life, say 10 to 15 years on a pivot or longer, it makes sense to move this direction. And again, I go back to, we are doing good use or well used on our nutrients, what we're doing in seed. And of course, if we think of the carbon footprint of fuel and repairs, all those tend to be largely the same because you're making the same passes. So make them count, right, is where that's at. So again, I come back to this, and I know, you know, from a farmer standpoint, they're like, well, yeah, this is just common sense. But honestly, Miranda, you pointed out earlier, if you don't know irrigation, you don't know these numbers, and you don't kind of see that backside to what it is under that, you know, setting of irrigated. The only other caveat I would offer here that isn't necessarily specific, but irrigated land then brings more value to the land. So if you are operating irrigated, yes, you get more yield, but you do have higher land expense just because it has more value, it has more productivity. So kind of factor those things in. But generally over the term, if you can think of in the most recent drought in 2021, significant differences. We watch that here. But even as I think to the 10-year average, you know, the last significant drought I'm aware of would be 2012. You know, there's still that idea that there's an advantage to irrigation over the long haul, despite what its additional cost may be, which is also helping us lead forward into what the new technology is and adoption that, yes, it's expensive, but if we can make a plan, cash flows for it operates, you know, year in, year out, then we can adopt that technology as well. And most people understand they want their farmer to be viable, right? They want that food on the shelf, very efficiently done, safely done, and at a reasonable price. And so they want that. But at the same time, we always want to be assured that we're making wise use decisions for the water that we're utilizing. And this particular map here, where I'll just finish up on comments, this is the pivots, the well pieces from the Minnesota DNR in terms of what their permits are. And so you'll see that density overlay on the counties that we, you know, I guess really look at for productivity. It's not that they don't exist elsewhere. And I will tell you that irrigation largely is expanding because it does make sense that if you can use wise use of resources, why don't we irrigate a little more with that? The other side that I would offer here that people always wonder, well, are we going to use our water up? Because they do hear the stories out of, say, Oklahoma or Nebraska. And those are completely different aquifers and much different situations. We have 30 and 40 year runs here in terms of looking at wells. We regenerate very well, I say it that way, no pun intended, on an annual basis. Sure, we have drawdown years like 2021. But if we look over a period of a couple of years, just are experiencing the snowfall from this winter, you know, we capture a fair amount of that water in our lowlands, and that feeds into our well system. So using water, we are, you know, water rich, really, when I think from a groundwater perspective. Obviously, we want to keep it clean. But on the other side, we don't have the issue that they would have at the Ogallala aquifer in Nebraska or others, where they do have issues where it's not regenerating as fast. So that's one advantage we have here. And that's why when we come to edible beans or potatoes, particularly in our soils, Minnesota and these soils become really a haven for growing them, because we have the water availability, we can put the technology on and grow a good crop that's good for our customer out there and good for farms. So with that, Miranda, that was kind of my summary without getting overboard on some of the economics around irrigation.
Well, so you mentioned something. So we always want to keep clean water in the back of our minds, right? So what are, besides doing the best you can with the use of your water and the, you know, the quantity of your water, what other conservation practices are you guys doing in your farms to save water, protect soil? What have you adapted on your farm, or what are you trying to adapt on your farm?
Not a lot for us. We've been, you know, cover crops are huge. Been doing a lot of cover crops behind, especially like edible beans and rye, these crops that are coming out early to keep something growing in there to trap moisture and as much as possible and keep our soils from blowing around. And then in the recent years, it's been reduced tillage, strip till and no-till planting.
Yeah, we're
before you go, Jake, what is a cover crop?
What is a cover crop?
Yeah, what's a cover crop?
I don't know. I'd have to look up in the dictionary if you're going to get technical with me. But I cover crop to me, I guess, is anything that, you know, is planted. Anything that's planted after, you know, something living in the soil, I guess, is how I would call it.
That's how I explained it to my 8-year-old this weekend. You know, you have windows of time where you don't have a crop that's growing that you're going to harvest. So it's important to having a living root in the soil, not only, you know, utilizing and keeping water in the soil profile, but also feeding our soil biology. And it also protects our soil from blowing away. When we talk about, you know, nitrates and we talk about phosphorus, when we see wind, you know, taking our soil away, that's when we start having phosphorus conversations. So cover crops are really a great tool for keeping our soil where we want it. Because Ryan, you want your topsoil, right?
Yes, I do.
Yes. And we want you to keep your topsoil. So cover crops are a really great tool for that.
I don't like giving it to my neighbor, so I'll keep it in my field.
Yeah, and in Minnesota, I mean, we all know the climate that, I mean, we've seen snow here for I think since November. So, I mean, 6 months out of the year, we're below freezing, you know, or around freezing. So with when we look at the crops that are irrigated, kidney beans, edible beans, potatoes, peas, sweet corn, a lot of that stuff does come off earlier. So it allows us to get to establish that cover crop. It minimizes our risk in establishing a cover crop. Because at the end of the day, cover crop still isn't, it still is a cost to our bottom line. So we kind of want to, we know there's a return, or, you know, we know that there's a benefit to the economics, the environment, but we also have to keep in mind, I know Keith, when I've heard you speak before and in our conversations, that balancing the economics with the environment. And I think that's such an important thing to look at when we talk about cover crops, because they aren't free. You know, we do have to pay for them and we have to take time across the field. But going back to the crops that are growing, we can take them out earlier. We can have time before freeze up to establish this cover crop. And then if you do like a rye per se, it will come back in the spring because it's a winter annual. It'll come back in the spring. And then if you don't want it to come green up in the spring, I know a lot of guys are blending wheat and rye together. So you get a little bit of, you still have that cover, that growth from the wheat or the oats, I should say. And then you do have a little bit of a cover crop greening up in the spring as well. We've made the mistake on experimenting. We're putting on way too much rye in the fall it got a little, it's an amazing plant. I'll tell you what, that the winter rye is quite incredible, and you can get yourself into trouble by all of a sudden not getting the soil to dry out soon enough for us to get back in the field in the spring. So it there's a lot of experimenting, a lot of doing different practices and trial and error, but I think the irrigation is what I try to message. I try to send out to people when I'm talking is that irrigation allows us to do these cover crops. And so that's a big important factor when having this discussion. So
I think that's really notable, Miranda, when you think of last fall, we were dry for quite a period of time. And so those that tried to establish cover crop in, say, August, we were waiting sometimes 8 to 10 weeks to get water. But if you had irrigation, you were able to establish that cover crop. So as Jake mentioned, this is a good advantage to have some irrigation when you're trying to establish cover crop late season.
Yep. And as important as cover crops are, and as I think they're really fun to work with because there's a lot to think about and there's a lot of little pieces to the puzzle. It's not the end all practice. It's a combination of all of the conservation practices utilized on your farm to make that work, because there's so many different species and you have to keep up with all of your other programs as well. It's not just going to the co-op, picking up some cover crop seed and throwing it out there. There's a lot of thoughts and puzzle pieces that go into that. But what, if you were to get in front of a group of people, what's one thing, you know, either as a farmer or as a representative of CLC or IAM, that you would want to tell someone driving along Highway 10, and I'm going to give it about a week, as potatoes are starting to get planted. What do you want people to know about farming? Who's ready to go?
It's not as easy as it looks. To the extent that you can, I really think you need to walk in their shoes. I think you need to get kicked by the markets. I think you need to get kicked by the weather. And I mean that literally, because if I come from a job mentality, right, where I have a paycheck that comes in every year, I know my income for the next 12 months. No farmer knows their income for the next 12 months. And we see that in the markets always, that, you know, you are trying your best to manage everything you can, excluding markets and weather, really, to come back to zero or making a profit, maintaining your land, right, and being able to pay bills. And that weighs on you pretty heavy because you've got all these factors. And then on the other side of this, how do we take what we have that we've made money on and be able to engage going forward that will position us to be competitive 10 and 15 years from now? And as we talked about earlier, the technologies are changing steady. So there's a lot that weighs on the mind. And it's one of those things, it's easy to be the, you know, the armchair quarterback or the person in the behind the windshield telling them what somebody should or shouldn't do. But I really think you got to walk in their shoes. So the every chance you get to be on farm and talk with farmers and understand some of the struggles they go through, I would encourage you to do that.
I love everything you said there, Keith. I think that that is, it goes back to education and having conversations and getting out on a farm and talking and seeing how things are done. Jake or Ryan?
Yeah, I guess just kind of like how Keith said that. I think like we just had a talk earlier today, was the overalls are not a thing that is seen on farmers anymore nowadays. You know, that's the thing of the past. So when you see a tractor, not, you know, we'd all wish to sit in a tractor most of the time every day, but that's honestly a minimal part of what farming is nowadays. There's a lot of office work, there's a lot of more paperwork and planning that really goes into it than anyone ever really sees. And you know, there's more farmers missing meals on their own to grow food. You know, we're running long hours and, you know, putting that ahead of a lot of other things in our life certain times of the year. So it's a lot more stressful than I think people see from the road. So
yeah, I would just say the same thing. Come visit us. Come, I mean, if obviously when it's go time and we're in the field, we never know what the weather is going to bring tomorrow. So it might, you know, we might be busy, but encourage you to stop in, you know, give us, I mean, as the Irrigator Association of Minnesota's president, my contact number's information is out there. Give us a call. Let's line up a field tour, a farm tour. I'd be more than happy to bring you around and look at the stuff and explain what we're doing and why we're doing it. And I think that we care more about the environment than we get credit for. We're constantly trying to balance that environment and the economics, but that's a challenge in itself. And I personally feel we do a phenomenal job with that. And I'm just encourage anybody to give us a call when in the times when we're not super, super busy during the summer. And like I said, just don't be afraid. We'd love to talk to you, love to show you around. And that's one thing that we try to do through the Irrigator Association is we have a field day every year. I know Keith has a field day every year to try to get people from the public out to see this new technology and see the new practices. And so, trying to just do those outreach programs and getting legislators out to the farms and showing them that. So I think it's an exciting area to be in because we're producing food for the world to eat, but yet there's a lot of stressful moments as well. We might seem calm on the surface, but below the water, the feet are moving. Because it can be when you're out of control, like he said, when you can't control the weather, which is the biggest factor that affects our bottom line every year, that's hard. We're trying to do the best we can when some of the factors that allow us to do our best aren't in our control. So.
Well said. Yeah, I was just thinking too, a lot of us, we've been farming the same ground for some people for over 100 years and it's still producing. So we're like, this land has been taken care of. So it's what feeds us, too. So mm-hmm. Most farmers are taking care of that land better than anybody because it's what they make their living off of. So and we're more like this, we're more than happy to share it with anybody, share our story.
Because I think we have a great story to tell. I really do. Just the generations. I mean, like Ryan said, 100 years. I mean, that's a long time to keep something productive. And as farmers, we've been able to do it. And we have, I always try to tell people is that, we own this. I mean, not that we don't own every acre that we farm, but even if the farms that we rent, I mean, in our mentality is that that's ownership. We own that. And you always are going to take care of things better when you own it. That's just human nature. And so that's, if you have stake in it, you have your blood, sweat, and tears in it, you're going to do as best job as you can. So that's, I guess that'd be the message I have.
That's great. And when I go into schools, I always ask my fifth graders if anyone's eaten today and they always say yes. So it's good to remember that if you want to eat, someone's got to grow your food. So with that, I just want to thank the three of you for joining me today and looking forward to getting some people out to your farms this summer.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you. This was great.
Yep.
Thank you. No, I really appreciate you doing this and including myself and all of us. I think it's a great thing what you're doing.